Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Nachhalt-Podcasts vom Nachhaltigkeitsbüro der HU. Heute wieder mit dem neuesten Vortrag aus unserer Ringvorlesungsreihe Der grüne Faden. Viel Spaß beim Zuhören!
Thank you so much for the kind introduction and thank you for having me today. So I'm a psychologist, specifically a cognitive scientist. So my work uses psychological principles to design behavioral solutions to address sustainability challenges and to inform environmental policy. So a lot of my work is geared toward transformational sustainability change. But this has to happen with two things. One is behavior change involving human beings, as well as system change that involves the changes in policy, infrastructure, and incentives. So behavior change alone is a necessary but insufficient condition for transformational change. Likewise, system change is also necessary but not sufficient. So I've worked on a new transformation model with my PhD student Rumi Nadal, this is a new conceptual framework on social transformation towards sustainability. And so let me go through this one step at a time. So my work mostly focuses on the top left quadrant here, which is on behavior intervention. So this is where we actually, you know, target a problematic behavior, for instance, recycling or waste management or climate, let's say carbon emissions to address climate change. And we identify or diagnose the behavioral barriers for this desirable behavior to occur. And with that in mind, we design and develop and test behavioral interventions to remove these psychological barriers to enable behavior change. So that's where most of my work occurs. Now, following individual behavior change, we also have the behavioral diffusion process. This is where a change in one individual propagates to many other individuals. So this is kind of a propagation of change to one person, to the collective. And this involves, you know, basically a diffusion process. This starts with early adopters. These are the innovators, creators, inventors, people who start to act first. That's a minority. And that propagates to the early majority of environmental change. So for instance, the most people in Vancouver have tried to become zero plastic waste. We are not using plastic, you know, bags or straws or containers. And that has become an ongoing social norm. And then after the early majorities, we have the late majorities. That's kind of the next 60 to 70% of the population. And the last part of the target group is the laggers. They probably will change last, and they're the most resistant to change. So we think that this behavioral diffusion process involves three types of behaviors specifically. One is private behaviors, the things I do in my own life, privately on a daily basis. There's also social signaling behaviors. So these could be behaviors that you do that you want other people to see. That could involve, you know, bringing a tote bag instead of plastic bags on the street, or sharing a pledge, sharing some information on social media. And also the last type of action is system changing actions. So these are civic actions that includes voting, donating to organizations, signing petitions, joining protests, et cetera, et cetera. So that's I think we need to change all three behaviors. But in today's talk, I'm going to focus primarily on private actions. So this is a behavioral change and diffusion process. On the right-hand side, we have the structural change process. So we have the, you know, starting from changes in institutions, in policies, in infrastructure. And that change can directly feed back to behavior change. So that complements behavior change in some way. And then finally, with behavior change and structural change, we should see new norms emerge, and the meanings of our actions will also change. Now, the meanings of mask wearing, for instance, were very different just a year ago from now. And then with I think transformation, we will see fundamental changes in social networks, even funding capacity, knowledge sharing, and leadership, for instance, So this is our collective framework on behavioral or system change on sustainability transformation. And again, I'm going to focus on the behavior change process alone here. So what's a behavioral intervention? I define this in terms of nudge. So a nudge is a change in the environment that alters people's behaviors in a predictable way. A nudge can increase the efficacy of a policy without forbidding certain options. It still allows you to choose any way you want. And it doesn't change the incentive structure significantly. So it doesn't, you know, impose tax or rewards on your current behaviors. And this is also the basis for behaviorally informed policy. And that's what I've been working on. So let me give you a first example of what a nudge is in the environmental sustainability domain. This is a default. This is basically the choice set that you're presented with to start. And the study was done in Germany with I think hundreds of German households. So on the left hand side, you have one condition. In this two panels, it's called contract A and contract B. This condition is opt-in. So basically you have an optional choice where you can check a box to say, I now want to purchase 100% green energy for my home. So this is opt-in. You have to opt-in by checking a box to purchase green energy. On the right two panels, this is the opt-out condition. So the default was the green energy option was pre-checked. So you have to opt out of the green energy to say, I don't want green energy, for instance. And what this study showed was in the opt-in condition, only 7% of the households purchased the green contract, which is a very small percentage. And that's kind of representative of a lot of the households in the world. But on the right-hand side, this is the opt-out condition, almost 70% of the households purchased a green energy choice. So it's not, this just demonstrates the power of default. It's not that, you know, we're educating people about the benefits of green energy, for instance. This is such a small intervention. It's a light touch intervention, just changing the default choice set that you're presented with. That has a tremendous impact on behavior. And that's the kind of behavioral interventions that I'm after, that involve small changes in the environment that can create a large impact on behavior. So the question is, how do we know which nudge works the best and for what reason? So to get at that, before we do anything, we started with a meta-analysis that we're still finishing at this point. It's a huge meta-analysis where we searched articles from 7 databases available to date. We started with 3,500 articles to start. We only looked at field experiments. So these are randomized controlled trials done in the field, not in the lab, where we randomly assign people into different conditions. And from the search is only from year 2008 to 2020, and 2008 being the publication of the book Nudge. And we only looked at real behavior measures instead of self-reports. So it's not survey measures. This is actual behaviors in terms of, let's say, energy use or recycling behaviors. Then we removed a couple of duplicates, many duplicates from title and abstract search alone. And finally, we arrived at 180 articles that are eligible in the search with over 200 effect sizes that we can find from these papers. Now, with these 200 effect sizes, we further classified them into 6 cognitive processes. So this is basically basic cognitive processes that govern human behavior, starting from attention to motivation. So by attention, we mean, basically we grab your attention. Any intervention will draw your attention using bottom-up features like color, font, size, motion, for instance. So that's what we mean by attention. Perception is a nudge where it frames information to influence your conscious interpretation of that information. So framing is basically a perceptual intervention. Memory is, for instance, is like a reminder. It is an intervention that uses encoding or retrieval cues to promote a certain action, just to remind you, hey, you don't forget to do this. Effort is changing the physical or the cognitive ease associated with an option. So how effortful you are, it is to, let's say, execute an action. Intrinsic motivation is, changing the inherent interests toward an option without changing anything external. An external motivation is using small rewards or punishments. These are not large, but small rewards or punishments to influence actions. And what we found in this meta-analysis was that effort-reducing nudges by far are the most effective ones. And the next most effective is attention-grabbing. So what this suggests is that if I want to change human behaviors effectively, I should make things easy. I should reduce the cognitive and physical effort associated with an action. The next one is, you know, attention drawing interventions. If I can draw your attention effectively, then that will lead to meaningful behavior change down the line. Okay, so what this means for my work was let's target effort and attention primarily, but also other factors like social and feedback interventions. So this is the EASE framework developed by the Behavioral Insights team in the UK first. EASE stands for easy, attractive, social, and timely. So let me go through each of those in a series of experiments. So let's just starting with EASE. This is convenience. This study came about back in the, you know, in 2015 when the city of Vancouver basically passed a bylaw that banned all food waste from the garbage stream in all family residences, so in single family or as well as multifamily residences. But after passing this bylaw, the food waste diversion rate was still very low. So the problem is, you know, the question is, now we have the right policy in place. How come we still don't see the right outcome? The people are not composting as they should. So we worked with a property management company where we first of all, identified behavioral barriers to composting. So there's several barriers. One is people tend to be in a rush. They tend not to have time. We you know, making a trip to the compost bin is time consuming and is also effortful. It's also really complicated to compost properly. You have to go through a lot of doors and then read the signs and to see what can go into the compost bin. So the question is, how can we encourage people to compost? Let's use convenience to increase the composting rate. So this study is done with a previous PhD student, Alex. We targeted three multifamily residential buildings in Vancouver. So we defined convenience in terms of the cleaning distance between your door and the bins. So basically how far you have to walk to the bins. And we, in the least convenient condition, we have the bins all the way in the back of the building. This is the status quo. It's the least convenient thing to do. We have to walk a long way to reach those bins. In the convenient condition, we place the bins on the ground floor by the elevator. In the most convenient condition, we place the bin on every floor by the elevator. So basically, you don't have to take the elevator. You just have to walk to the elevator and compost. And we measure the amount of compost per week and per unit in the study. And we found that the compost volume more than doubled when the bins are on your floor as opposed to on the ground floor or all the way in the back of the building. So this is a huge effect that we see from the study. We further replicated the study with two high-rise buildings on UBC campus with almost 2,000 students, where we parametrically manipulated convenience. So the bins are either 5 feet away, it's literally outside your door, or all the way 163 feet away from your door. And we looked at not just composting, we looked at all kinds of recycling as well. But this is, the volume of recycling, so composting per week per student in this study. We found that composting increased by 139% when the bins are 5 feet away versus 41 feet away. It's a small distance in our minds, but it actually it's a huge psychological barrier to composting. The effect was enormous here. The same effect was seen in paper recycling, which increased by 137% when the bins are 5 feet away versus 41 feet away, or container recycling. So this study demonstrates the power of recycling, that, you know, basically by moving the bins closer to you, we can dramatically increase the volume of composting and recycling. And this will help cities around the world to achieve their zero waste target. So for instance, our city will go zero waste in, you know, the next 20 years. So when I presented this study to the city, it was well received. But the comment I get, this is the overwhelming comment I get from policymakers, was it's an impressive set of results from a study, but this is actually really hard and expensive to do for stakeholders. Reason being, putting bins closer to people's doors involve more bins and more custodial staff to manage those bins. Who's paying for that? That's a logistical challenge that a lot of stakeholders have to figure out. But regardless, we still demonstrate the impact of psychological convenience on composting and recycling. So this made me rethink our approach to ask, maybe there's a cheaper way to use convenience. And this is where we turn into signage. Recycling signage is probably one of the most confusing things to read. I don't know about Germany, but in Canada or US, there are all kinds of different plastics that we need to sort. Sometimes the signs are crowded with yes items and no items. So the thing that I see people do is they stand in front of the bin for a few minutes, getting confused, they frown, and they throw stuff away in the garbage bin. And then they turn away, hoping that they got it right. So how can we simplify signage and help people, sort more accurately? This is what I mean by cognitive ease. So how can we reduce the cognitive effort associated with recycling and composting decision-making? Okay, so the way to do this, let's improve the signage. How can we, make the signage more user-friendly? So to do this, the study is done with a previous student, David Wu. We have people come into the lab where we ask people to sort virtual items on a computer screen, and we track their hand motion as they sort. What we did was we presented, objects on the screen and say, here's a container, where does this thing go? So they have to sort this item virtually on the computer screen into one of the four bins. We looked at different conditions. We looked at whether the signage was only pictures versus texts, actual labels, English labels of those items. We looked at yes items only or having yes and no items combined on the signage. We also looked at whether the bin order was consistent or it was random every single time. That's another challenge. If the order of the bins was, let's say it was random or inconsistent, that can create another cognitive barrier to sorting. So these are all conditions. And we looked at sorting efficiency. This is basically a score of accuracy divided by reaction time. So basically, the more accurate you are, the faster you are at sorting, the more efficient you are at sorting. What we found was pictures increased sorting efficiency by 25% compared to texts. So the implication from this is let's use pictures. Let's show pictures, not texts, in signage. Having yes items only increased the sorting efficiency by 12% compared to yes and items combined. These are all statistically significant. So what this means is that only show yes items. Don't even bother with these no items on the signage. And the last finding was a consistent order of the bins increased the sorting efficiency by 37% compared to a random order every single time. So the implication is that we should standardize the order of the bins across an area, across a jurisdiction, as opposed to having a random order of bins when you sort. So several jurisdictions have taken our insights into heart and actually implemented these insights. So for instance, UBC, this is our campus. The campus has standardized the signage and the bin order across the university. And the signage only shows pictures, or in this case, icons, which work the same equally well as pictures. The city of Vancouver has also done the same across the whole city. It standardizes the bin order as well as the signage with only pictures. So this is one behavioral insight from ease, which is physical and cognitive convenience can increase sorting actions. Now let me turn into attractive. So this involves drawing attention to certain things to increase that action by making things salient. So here I turn into water conservation. A prominent behavioral barrier to water conservation is the unawareness of how much water is being used on a daily basis. I don't know about you guys, but I don't get any feedback about my water consumption at all because I live in an apartment building in Vancouver. unless you have a smart water meter, if you live in a single family unit, you may have water feedback, water consumption feedback every couple months. But most of people, at least in the city of Vancouver, don't get any feedback about their water consumption. So how can we encourage people to save water using salience? So in this experiment, we asked people to wash dishes. It's actually, you know, they wash basically cups covered in chocolate syrup. They either wash the cups in front of a clear tank. That's, you know, basically you turn on a tab and you wash the cups in the sink. And you can see the water level drop as you wash the cups. So that's the clear condition. In the other condition, we cover the tank up so the water use is opaque. You don't see any, you know, you don't get any feedback or indicator as to how much water you've used. And here we looked at their actual water consumption in the experiment by tracking their perceived use of water as well as actual use of water. So what we found was the water use decreased by 32% when the tank was clear versus when it was covered. So just making the water resource transparent has an automatic 30% reduction on water use. And this is quite phenomenal as well. We further manipulated how much water you have to start. So previously the tank was full, but now in this experiment, we either have a tank like basically a quarter full, so not much water to use, versus half full, so you have, you know, half a tank to use. And what we found was the water use decreased by 38% when the tank was quarter full versus half full. So the implication was, if you think that you have less water to use, then you use less water. You become more efficient. You use less resources. If you think the resource is scarce. So that's kind of the power of salience is, you know, just by making the water resource transparent can reduce water consumption. Even more, priming kind of a scarce water resource and can also reduce water consumption. And this will, you know, again, help many cities in the world to achieve water conservation targets. But the challenge with this implication, with this, you know, behavior insight was it's also expensive. I don't know anyone who's willing to retrofit their entire sink and bathtub, for instance, just so they can make the water resource transparent. But the implication from this study was in designing future sinks or future homes or any kind of, you know, water or, you know, faucets, we should take this insight into consideration and try to make the pipes or the tanks transparent as we can to the individual consumer. Now, how can we, you know, do this at a relatively cheaper level? This is where I teamed up with a startup company in the Silicon Valley, where we designed a product called the Dropler. It's simply a device that you can put near the sink or in the kitchen. This device listens to water sounds in the environment. It presents a light bar, which represents your water budget of the day. So let's say today I'm only going to use 2 gallons of water, which is incredibly low. And the bar will gradually decrease with water use. So it will light up every time it detects a water sound in your home, and it will start to decrease as you use water. So in other words, this device presents a real-time visual indicator of your water consumption. So I think, you know, this is a promising sort of intervention with technological development to change human behavior. So this is one way to present, you know, at least water use to people. Now, let me generalize this to plastic waste, which is a really urgent issue at this point. Every year we dump, you know, 20 million tons of plastic waste into the ocean that directly harms marine life and water. In the current COVID-19 pandemic, this volume has dramatically increased due to the increasing use of single-use containers, gloves, or masks. So when we you know, think about plastic waste, a behavioral barrier to plastic waste reduction was that we don't know the downstream consequences of our actions. Every time I throw away a plastic bottle or plastic container, I don't know where that bottle goes, and I don't know what the consequence of my bottle is on, let's say, marine life. So how can we, you know, make the consequence more salient to discourage plastic waste? And this is a particular timing because Canada as a nation is going to go zero plastic waste in the next 10 years or 9 years. It's extremely ambitious. In particular, the government is banning single-use plastics nationwide. So the question how is, even with the right policy in place, let's say, how can we make sure that people follow the policy and achieve the policy target? So to do this, this is my PhD student, Yu, and I ran a study with OceanWise, which is a nonprofit conservation organization, where we design all kinds of signage to discourage plastic waste. In particular, we design a signage with a marine animal trapped in plastic debris. So for instance, in this case, it's a dolphin that's trapped in a plastic bag. So the idea here is let's highlight the downstream consequence of our actions. And maybe that would deter people from throwing away plastic waste. And this is the full set of posters we came up with, or signage we came up with. So we presented either turtles or dolphins trapped in plastic debris as a deterrent, behavioral deterrent of plastic waste. What we did was we counted the number of plastic items in all bins in this particular environment. And what we found was the only effective intervention was the signage with the animal trapped in plastic debris. That actually led to an 18% reduction in plastic waste compared to all the other conditions. So this highlights the promise of, you know, salience by highlighting the consequences of our actions to downstream, let's say, environments. Now, I've shown you a lot of experiments demonstrating the power of salience. The next question is, does salience always work, right? We can't assume that this will always work regardless of the population or the intervention. So now we turn into something more controversial, at least within North America, which is climate change. So the question is, how does drawing attention to climate change evidence influence climate actions? So to do this, we first took global temperature from NOAA. This is the global temperature in Fahrenheit, starting 1880 to, I think, 2017 in this case. And we highlighted the rising face of the curve in red. So by highlighting the curve, part of the curve in red, we hope to draw people's attention to that rising face of the temperature. And this is, to us, this is quite strong evidence for climate change. In a control condition, we simply did the reverse. We highlighted the flatter face in red. So we're drawing attention away from, you know, climate change evidence. And after participants see this graph, we presented two actions. One is signing a pledge to stand with the Nature Conservancy to call upon US leaders to stand strong on climate change. That's one action. The second action is donation. Would you donate to Natural Resource Defense Council to address climate change? So these are two climate actions we looked at. First of all, let's make sure that we actually draw people's attention to the curve. So we use eye tracking. This is simply looking at their eye gaze on this curve, global temperature curve. And what we found was in the rising phase in red condition, there was indeed greater attention to the rising phase. And likewise, in the flatter face in red condition, there was greater attention or eye gaze, at least to the flatter face. So in other words, our manipulation worked. We did successfully draw people's attention to different parts of the curve. Now the question is, does that biased attention actually change people's actions? Does that intervention actually work? We split our participants into a liberal group and a conservative group. Let's say Democrats versus Republicans in this case. We found really interesting results here, which was drawing attention to the rising phase, the kind of the salient evidence of climate change, actually, you know, increased actions in liberals, but it discouraged actions in conservatives. So the effect was opposite for conservatives as opposed to liberals. And that was really surprising to us, because this suggests that you cannot use the same intervention and expect that this would have the same impact for everyone in the target audience. In fact, if the intervention doesn't align with people's prior motivations and ideologies, then that intervention most likely will fail. And not just fail, but maybe backfire. So this basically suggests that we shouldn't use salience, but carefully. We should make sure that the salience intervention is motivationally consistent. So let me stay on climate change for a little bit. Let me pose this question to the audience. Does anyone know what is the most effective individual action to reduce carbon emissions? Thank you. I see a lot of responses. Great. I hope you can see the responses as well. No, not extreme. Some of the responses are really extreme. I gotta say. Okay, so here's the response. The most effective one is having one fewer child. This does not mean suicide. This does not mean that you should not have any children, right? So this is, I'm just looking at the responses here, because some of the responses are quite extreme, right? Does not mean that you shouldn't have any children. It shouldn't mean you should, you know, go that far, but that just means that instead of having maybe five children, you should consider having four. So just have one fewer child. And that has a huge reduction potential. In the US, for instance, that can reduce 120 tons of carbon a year. This is basically benchmarked against a lot of data from different countries. The second one, so let's leave that controversial action of having one fewer child alone. The next one is live car free. I think some of you mentioned, you know, drive less, there's also flying less. So if you live car free, that will save about 2 tons of carbon emissions per year. That was also followed by flying less. So this is avoid one transatlantic flight. This is from, let's say, from New York to Paris. That's about 1.6 tons of carbon. Just one return flight, economy class. And then some of you also mentioned green energy. Yes, that's also, you know, effective, but depends on where. So for instance, in the UK, that's not effective because the energy production in the UK is already pretty carbon not intense. Whereas in the US and Canada and Australia, going from traditional sources, fossil fuel sources to green energy can save you about a ton a year. And the next, I think a few are, you know, switching to more efficient cars. And the last effective action is going plant-based diet. So some of you mentioned going vegan, you know, eat less meat. That is effective, but it would only save you just less than a ton of carbon emissions per year. So it's nowhere close to driving less or flying less, but it's still pretty effective. So these are the kind of the most effective actions. Then there's moderate impact actions like recycling, basically washing your clothes in cold water, hand dry clothes, and upgrading your light bulbs. So these are not as impactful as the green actions. So when we ask this same question to people in the North American public, we get pretty much the same responses as I see from you. The most common one being drive less. People think that's the most effective, but actually, it is effective. But nobody actually mentioned saying one fewer child. And this kind of misunderstanding of the impact of our actions is true for both conservative individuals and liberal individuals. So across the political spectrum, it turns out that people have, not an accurate understanding of the carbon savings of individual actions. Another question, this is slightly more precise. How many miles can you drive in a hybrid car that will produce the same amount of carbon emissions as driving 100 miles in a conventional car? By conventional, I mean gasoline powered. So how far do you think you can go in a hybrid vehicle that will produce the same carbon emissions as driving 100 miles in a conventional car? 160 kilometers. Okay, great. There are a lot of nuances to this calculation, but the average correct answer is 200 miles, give and take. Depends on the car, the specific car, and also whether is it highway driving or city driving. But on average, you can drive about, you know, twice as far in a hybrid vehicle as a conventional car that produces the same amount of carbon emissions. Next question. How many hamburgers do you have to give up to offset the carbon emissions from one transatlantic flight? It makes me laugh every time I see 5,000 or something like 10,000 or 100,000. That's an expensive hamburger. That's nuanced because it depends on where the beef comes from, et cetera, et cetera. But the average correct answer is 300. So it's about, you know, 300 hamburgers that produce the same amount of carbon as one flight, you know, across the Atlantic. So I'm not going to ask more questions, but these are the questions we asked in our participants. Basically, you can burn 300 hours of an LED light bulb that produces the same amount of carbon emissions as doing one load of hand-dried laundry. And you can use 10 years of unpackaged food that produces the same amount of carbon emissions as, you know, going 1 year on a vegetarian diet. So when we asked the question to, again, the public, the estimates are incredibly variable, just like what I see here in the chat. The red bars, the red zone, indicates the correct response. Depending on where you live, depending on, you know, the energy source, for instance, you are correct as long as you're within the red zone. But the gray bars are people's estimates. There is the public responses to these questions. And as you can see, that is the people are incredibly inaccurate. We also looked at whether you're an expert in sustainability or climate science or environmental science, whether you took any courses in environmental science or sustainability. That has zero correlation with your accuracy. So what this means is that regardless of your expertise or knowledge in climate change or sustainability, people are equally inaccurate at doing these kind of questions. So what this shows is that we need to bridge a knowledge gap of carbon emissions associated with individual actions in the public. So I think this is one crucial initiative going forward. Okay, so this is attractive. Let me look at the third factor, which is social. How can we make things social? This again, I'm going back to waste reduction here. So as I said, recycling, composting doesn't really reduce your carbon emissions, but it does alleviate the pollution challenge or crisis. It will decrease the pollutants in the environments, but it doesn't really reduce the carbon emissions. Okay, so we looked at a public event called the Apple Festival, where people gather, over 10,000 visitors gather over the course of a day or two. And at this public event, enormous amount of waste was generated. So the question was, how can we reduce waste at public events? And we basically did a couple of different, tried different interventions. One is having a volunteer, who stands next to the bins. Or we designed different bin tops with even 3D items. These are the real life objects that indicate, you know, they should go into this bin compared to the control group. And our measure was contaminants. So the amount of items that shouldn't go into each bin per kilogram per bin. And what we found was the volunteer condition led to the greatest amount of a reduction in contamination. So they actually reduces contamination by 85 to 97% across all bins compared to any of the other conditions. So the implication is that we should at least, you know, use these social, you know, social presence as an intervention to reduce plaque waste contamination at public events. Okay, so the last factor is timely. So how can we produce timely feedback? So at the beginning, I told you about the power of convenience, but convenience doesn't tell you what goes where. It just makes things a little easier. So a barrier for correct sorting is the lack of feedback on my sorting actions. So how can we reduce contamination with immediate feedback? So to do this, we designed a sorting game. So this is a computer game. It's online. It's about 2 minutes where you sort objects in this game. And every time you sort, or you were presented with a feedback, some kind of, you know, feedback of whether you did it correctly, or if you did it incorrectly, we tell you where this item should have gone instead. So in an experiment, what we found was sorting accuracy improved by 30% after getting this feedback compared to a condition that didn't get the feedback. And this benefit lasted for over 3 weeks since you played the game in the first place. So this shows that just providing real-time immediate feedback can increase sorting accuracy. And since the publication of our paper, many sorting games have been developed and used in across the world. For instance, UBC has its own sorting game that every incoming student has to play as part of their orientation. They have to play this game to know, like, to know the campus, to know how to sort properly on campus. The City of Vancouver created Advanced Sort. It's another free game they host on the city's website to encourage people in Vancouver to learn how to sort. This is from the Environmental Protection Agency in the US. They have their Recycle City sorting game that's available to anybody in the US, as well as this is the City of Davis in California. They designed their own sorting game based on our principles. So timely feedback can reduce contamination for waste, at least for waste streams. Okay, so implications for policy. For an environmental policy to be effective, we should make sure that the implementation is easy, salient in a social context, or with a timely feedback. So at least these are the simple guidance from our studies. When it comes to climate change, we should make sure the communication should be tailored to people's prior motivations. Otherwise, it won't work, or it will backfire in some cases. We should also target public blind spots when it comes to carbon emissions associated with the specific actions. And lastly, we should make sure that interventions at scale are relatively easy and cheap for stakeholders for widespread adoption. Okay, so I'm going to end here. I want to thank my lab, my funding sources. I want to thank you for your attention and your participation.